I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, good grief. The head of our state's public school system is suggesting that right-wing influencers are colluding with Russia to push school choice. Plus, Bob sticks to his big lie on education. And today on Florida Report, voters there are going to decide whether the state's six-week abortion ban is too extreme. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback. I want to start the show with kind of, I think, an unusual story for us to do off the top, but it speaks to two different issues. One of them is what's happening in independent media. It's a major story all over the place right now. But then there's a tie between that story and the head of our state's public school system that's just very, very odd. So let's dive into it. One of the reasons this is of interest to me and why I think you deserve for us to talk about it and talk about it openly and plainly is there's this big criminal case involving right-wing, as the mainstream media, but conservative influencers. Now, the conservative influencers aren't accused of doing anything wrong. They're actually victims in this case. But I think it ties into concerns over independent media, who's influencing them, where they're getting their money. And frankly, we're independent media. So let's talk about it, shall we? So this is from the Associated Press. The headline, right-wing influencers were duped to work for covert Russian influence operation, U.S. says. An indictment filed Wednesday alleges a media company linked to six conservative influencers, including well-known personalities Tim Pool, Dave Rubin, and Benny Johnson, was secretly funded by Russian state media employees to churn out English language videos that were often consistent with the Kremlin's interest in amplifying U.S. domestic divisions in order to weaken U.S. opposition to Russian interests like its war in Ukraine. In addition to marking the third straight presidential election, which U.S. authorities have unveiled politically charged details about Russia's attempted interference in U.S. politics, an indictment indicates how Moscow may be attempting to capitalize on the skyrocketing popularity of right-wing podcasters, live streamers, and other content creators who have found successful careers on social media in the years since Trump was in office. So basically what this alleges is that RT, which we all know what that is, so RT, Russia Today, which is the Kremlin's media arm, which for some reason is allowed to sort of, at one point at least, I think people are wise to it, but at one point, I mean, you had respected journalists working for RT, and it was like, well, it's being funded by Russia in the background. But RT is this Russian media entity. Well, according to this indictment, two employees of RT were responsible for funneling millions of dollars behind the scenes into something called Tenet Media. Now, Tenet Media is similar if you, it's not similar, but the same idea if you subscribe to this show on Patreon. We use Patreon as a platform that already exists where we can host our content there and they can help us collect money from subscribers who pay, you know, $5 a month for the show. So what Tenet Media described itself as is a network of heterodox commentators that focus on Western political and cultural issues. So it's much different than Patreon in the sense that Patreon is for creators of all kinds. You could create art and have a Patreon page and sell people your art through Patreon. You could have a political podcast. You could have a podcast on cooking or whatever it is. So Patreon is just a platform that we use so we don't have to pay to create our own website, you know, try to figure out a way to collect subscriptions from subscribers and put out subscriber content. But Tenet specifically was for a certain kind of independent content creator, namely conservatives who kind of aligned with them. This AP article goes on to say that Tenet Media's six main influencers have more than 7 million subscribers on YouTube and more than 7 million followers on X. The indictment shows that some of the influencers were paid handsomely for their work. One unidentified influencer's contract included a $400,000 monthly fee, a $100,000 signing bonus, and an additional performance bonus. Patreon doesn't pay us anything, just to be clear. And if I was making $400,000 a month, I don't know what I would do. And I, you know, for me, some of the influencers that have been caught up in this, and again, they were duped into this. And, you know, people are arguing online, should they have known? Should they have done more to know that they were like being funded backdoor by Russia? I don't know. But I don't think it's fair to say like, you idiots. But I'm also not, I really have no opinion on them being paid, one of them being paid $400,000 a month. I mean, they've earned and built massive followings that reach millions and millions of people. And so if they're able to monetize it in that way, fine, but only to find out that they were getting paid that much in part by the Russian government. So let me talk about this angle of the story first before I move on to the next one. And actually, in our daily subscriber show poll, which we'll get to later on, I asked you guys, and we've talked about it on the show before, I think that there are concerns about the rise in independent media. Valid concerns. Concerns that I think about often. I've talked about it being kind of the wild, wild west. You know, the independent media grew out of this real growing frustration among Americans, particularly Americans on the right, that mainstream news wasn't fair, was incredibly biased toward the Democratic Party, and that conservatives, conservative candidates, Republicans would not only not get a fair shake or fair coverage, but there would be coverage that actively sought to attack them and to undermine them. And so when you have roughly half the country who says media is just not working for me, it's working against me, it opened up this whole area to say, is there someone else who's going to fill the void? And so that's when you start to see, I mean, when you look at independent media in America, the vast majority of it is conservative. And there's a reason for that. They're not being served in any way by old media, let's call it. So, you know, I've said on the show before that what I think needs to happen is that independent outlets need to become so successful. And we're starting to see that, right? Like the Daily Wire and you know, they've built this huge empire that stretches not only from news, but into documentary, into movies, into books, into children's programming. I think they need to get so successful and so profitable that they're taking away significant amounts of money from corporate media. And so corporate media and the mainstream networks and old media has to decide like, hey, clearly people don't want what we're giving them anymore. So maybe we do need to be fair. Maybe we do need to make an effort to be unbiased. And so there's going to be this snapback effect. And I would be okay with that. I would be okay with independent media like our podcast being a means to an end. You know, I spend a lot of time on this show, as I'm going to again on the show today, criticizing old media in Seattle. I was telling people the other day, unsubscribe from the Seattle Times. Turn off your TVs. Don't give them your views. Don't give them your clicks. Don't click on their articles that help them sell advertising if you're not happy with what they're doing. And so I would be more than happy if we are able to successfully help old media make a decision to really look at what they're doing and change their ways and get back to more how, you know, the media used to be and a long time ago and the core tenets of the job and their responsibility. And if that leads to us being irrelevant, that's fine. I would rather have the media as an institution, journalism as an institution, the Fourth Estate correct itself and serve the American people, the people of our state better than I would if I could trade it and say either our show is going to be a resounding success for years to come, or our show is a resounding success for a short period of time because then old media learned what was going on, fixed itself, decided to be fair, and actually serve people instead of one political party like they're doing now. And then they were back on top. Like, fine, I'd be fine with that. We'd find other things to do. So, you know, but I always understand that there's these issues where it's the Wild West and you don't know who's credible. I mean, the only benefit for me was I'd already been in this market for 13 years talking about politics and covering the news. And so I had some built up credibility there. But for a lot of the influencers who are out there doing, you know, whatever their brand of journalism or commentary is, you know, you don't know if they're credible. You don't know what their standards are, certainly for what standards they hold themselves to. You know, if they get something wrong, do they care? Where are they getting their information from? So that all of that ranges so widely, not that mainstream media cares about standards anymore either. And then there's the funding aspect of it. You know, where are they getting their money? Have they looked into the entities and the organizations that are funding them? In this case, you know, Tenet Media being given money by the Russian government to prop up right-wing or conservative commentators. So I want you to know that I see all that. And that's why I made that our daily subscriber poll today, is I'm curious what your concerns are. And I'll give you guys some time to answer that poll if you haven't already on Patreon, Locals and X. And we'll talk about it coming up in comments at the end of the show. But I think about these things all the time. And we just make a decision to hold ourselves to a certain standard, a certain journalistic standard, even though we do commentary. And then, you know, as far as the funding goes, most of our funding comes from you, directly from you. It's not like you guys are picking up the phone and asking us like to cover things a certain way. And we're saying, okay, as long as you keep paying us. So it's just about policing yourselves. But can the independent media police itself, especially when some of these people are making so much money? Are you willing to give up that money if the source of it is a little bit sketchy or whatever it is? But again, I don't blame these influencers, podcasters who are part of this, because it really sounds like they were duped and it was pretty sophisticated. So that's part of it. So, you know, I'm curious what you guys have to say about all that. You know, I've been on Tim Pool's show. I was never like told when I got there, you can say this, you can't say this, or, you know, this was before, I believe it was before Russia invaded Ukraine. And I was just a guest and nobody told me what I could say or couldn't say. So I certainly didn't experience that. And I had a wonderful time while I was there. And no, Russia didn't pay me to say that. I did have a wonderful time while I was there. So let's move on to the second aspect of this story, because it's just wild. So here you have, you know, some people on the left who are now going to say, oh, these guys should have known that they were being paid by Russia. And it's very clear based on what they were saying and anti-Ukraine animus and all of this. And so, you know, you kind of expect that. What I didn't expect is for this story to be used to undermine those of us who support school choice. I didn't see the nexus there, but some people apparently saw it. So there's a guy named Josh Cohen on Twitter, and he was responding to a CNN article about this Russia-funded US media thing. And he said this. He said, pro-voucher influencers have long used the right-wing platforms from Tenet Media, to attack public schools and hawk school voucher schemes. All right. So that's a leap. So basically what he's suggesting is that Tenet Media use these right-wing influencers and force them to take a position as being in favor of school choice. Like, again, no evidence of that. And in doing that, he would make some, that sounds like he's making some sort of assertion that Russia has like has a reason to support school choice and charter schools for American students over public schools, which sounds a little odd. I'll get to that more in a moment. But why do I care? Why do I care what some dude named Josh Cohen says on social media? Well, he has written about this. This is sort of his area. He's a professor and senior fellow at Ed Law Center. He's the author of a book called Privateers: How Billionaires Created a Culture War and Sold School Vouchers. So he is very anti-school choice. Very anti-school choice, so much so that he wrote a book about it. Still, well, Brandy, why do you care? Why do you care if some dude who's anti-school choice, who wrote a book about it, has something to say about right-wing influencers? Well, I care because the head of Washington State's public school system apparently cares. Chris Rakedahl, the superintendent of public instruction, shared that author's tweet and added this. Russia, right-wing political peddlers, public school vilification, and voucher pumpers. It's organized and neoliberal silence is complicity. Let me read that one more time. Russia, right-wing political peddlers, public school vilification, and voucher pumpers. It's organized and neoliberal silence is complicity. Wow. So here you have the head of our state's public school system, who is using some story about an indictment where the Russian government is funneling money to Tenet Media, which is handing that money out to conservative podcasters and influencers for videos and for coverage. And you have the head of our state's public school system who is tying all of that to the reason why some people are pro-school choice and support school vouchers. Think of how crazy that is. Think of how crazy that is. Russia, right-wing political peddlers, public school vilification, and voucher pumpers. It's organized. So he's drawing a direct line. If you are vilifying our public schools, you must be right-wing or tied to Russia in some way. If you are pumping vouchers, pushing school choice and school choice vouchers as a solution to our states and our nation's education woes, you must be like funded by the Russian government or unduly influenced by Russia or right-wing podcasters. That is the current head of Washington State's public school system, who apparently can think of no other reason why anyone would possibly support school choice. He doesn't want to blame himself, right? He doesn't want to blame the state of our education system. So he's like, what do I do? Do the liberal math. Oh yeah, Russia, right wing. We'll blame Russia for the fact that in the city of Seattle, what is it, 20 elementary schools might have to close by 2025, a story that we've talked about quite a bit. So that's easier, right? Oh, instead of like, you know, looking at declining enrollment and we might have to close a bunch of elementary schools, not just in the city of Seattle, but all over the state, that is a direct result in the eyes of the public schools chief, the superintendent of public instruction. That's like Russia tied. Oh, Russia influenced people, podcasters to be anti-school choice. This is crazy. To be pro-school choice. And then that's why parents took their kids out of the schools. And that's why we have to close all these schools. Like, nothing at all to do with the sad state of our education system. Nothing at all to do with the fact that in math, science, and English language, our students are failing across the board. That of the 1.1 million students currently enrolled in a Washington public school, only 50% are meeting English language standards, only 39% are meeting math standards, only 43% are meeting science standards, only 83% are graduating, only 69% of students attended school on a regular basis, only 69% had an attendance of 90% or more. And all of that while we're paying $18,000 per pupil. And instead of looking at any of that and saying, well, maybe that's why enrollment is down, because kids aren't learning and parents realize that. Maybe enrollment is down because we're focusing on political and social agendas and it's bothersome to parents. Not that right-wing podcasters are making that up because they've been paid by Russia to do so. That is like how little, frankly, someone I used to have a little bit of respect for. Chris Reichdahl used to come on this show and try to answer our questions. And I at least gave him credit for that. But that's how little he thinks of parents who want to make the best possible decision for their kids when it comes to education. And he wants to say that you would only support school choice, like, and he's suggesting that in his tweet, if you like have been so brainwashed by right-wing Russia-funded influencers, right? Meanwhile, he doesn't want to acknowledge who's influencing him. And who do you think that is? The Washington Education Association. If there's anyone who's brainwashed here, it's the head of our public school system, and he's being brainwashed by the most powerful union in the state, the teachers' union. And there's no other possible explanation. Why would you, as someone who's dedicated your life to the education of kids, why would you not want every child and every family to be able to make an educational decision that's best for them? Why would you not want them to be able to decide, hey, maybe public school isn't for my kid, but I'm paying taxes, I'm paying into our school system, so I want a voucher to be able to take my child to a different school that's not a public school where I think that they would excel. If you're an educator at the core, if you care about quality education of kids, why would you be opposed to giving them a choice? If you think the public schools are providing a quality education for kids, if you think public schools are great places to learn, Chris Reichdahl, if you think you have fostered and created a public school system that's providing a quality education and that is a good place for kids to learn, then you shouldn't be afraid about opening up another option because parents won't choose it, right? If they have two options and free will as a parent, and you think that our public schools are better, then you should have no concerns because the parent will take their kid to public school. But that's not the case. He knows that if given vouchers, if given school choice, that enrollment will decline even more. And who's hurt when enrollment declines? The teachers and the teachers' union. So the Washington Education Association will never let Chris Rakedal support school choice. They will never acknowledge how bad our public school system is failing. And why would they now? When the head of the public school system is saying the only reason our public schools are failing, the only reason enrollment is down is because Russia gave money to right-wing influencers to convince us all to pull our kids out of public schools. I'll use a line from the Seattle Times editorial board. That makes him unfit. Now, they use that line to talk about his opponent. But I think it's fair to say, you know, the Seattle Times ed board, they endorsed Chris Rakedal because they said that something his opponent said was disqualifying. That he said that he wants more kids going to trade schools and not to universities. And they said that's disqualifying. So that's disqualifying, but this isn't disqualifying. Vilifying parents as dumb, like, stooges of right-wing propaganda. Give me a break. Give me a break. Insane. So fascinating story with a lot of different angles. And we will reach out again to Chris Rakedal. He's declined our request for an interview related to his campaign for superintendent of public instruction. So David Olson will be in. We actually have an interview we're taping with him today. And so his opponent will be in to talk about his campaign. But perhaps Chris Rakedal will come on in his capacity as a public schools chief. All right, I just want to note quick, closing the loop on this. So there has been a hand recount going on in Washington State in the Commissioner of Public Lands race, and it has now been certified officially by the Secretary of State's office. It was certified I think it was last night or just early this morning. So officially, Jamie Herrera Butler, who we knew was going to advance, her opponent is going to be a Democrat, Dave Updegrove, for a long time. So it had been a 51-vote difference between the second and third place finisher, Dave Updegrove, and Sue Keel Peterson. So there had been a hope from Republicans that, man, if you can get two Republicans through, so Jamie and Sue, then we'll for sure have a Republican as the next lands commissioner. But after the primary election night counts, she was 51 votes behind. So that was disappointing. And so what happened after the recount? Was there a big swing in one direction or another? No, but there was a swing of two. So, I mean, actually, it's not bad. You do a full recount and you only find two sort of wonky ballots and you fix them. I don't know what the issue was with those two ballots, if they were deemed to be, like, not correct voters or not signed and they couldn't be cured. I don't know what the issue is, but it went from a 51 vote difference to a 49 vote difference. So Sue Keel Peterson lost by 49 votes, and we were 49 votes away from Republicans recapturing statewide office on the West Coast. So what do we say?
I mean, guaranteed. They still could.
What do you mean?
It would have been a guaranteed statewide office.
Thank you. Yes. They're still going to.
They're still going to.
Because Dave Reichert's going to win, and maybe some others as well. Well, I think Jamie Herrera Butler can easily win.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm. But vote, for the love of God. I don't want to have this dance again in November.
Ugh.
Back, oh my gosh, don't even get me started. Okay, gosh, we got to get to some media failures coming up next, has that become my beat? I guess.
Well, they asked for it.
Well, they give me so much material.
Yeah.
I got endless material on the media failures to call out lies from elected officials and media failures to stop shilling for political candidates. All right. First, I was just thinking about, I took Lucky for a walk yesterday. She came down to the memorial with us for Ruth, and which I'll talk about at the end of the show today. And I was like traumatized by what people would say about my dog.
Oh,
you know why? Because I posted that video of Lucky at Natchez RV Resort going over the little doggy. Mm-hmm. I can never think of this word. The doggy.
The obstacle.
Obstacles.
Course.
Obstacles. And people on the internet called her fat. And so I was like, oh my gosh, is my dog fat? Like, I'm going to take her out in public. And are they going to call her fat? Everybody was very nice.
Nobody
obviously.
Called her fat.
Nobody called her fat, but I was traumatized.
She's not fat.
Traumatized, I tell you. Traumatized. Anyway, all of that to segue into, if you have an RV and you're looking for a place to call it home, Natchez RV Resort is awesome. They got the doggy obstacle course, which is pretty cool. A little dog park. They've also got pickleball courts. They just finished their 4,300 square foot clubhouse, which is totally cool. Well, where else are you going to get that? Where you can pull in your RV and then you have all this space to hang out with guests, friends, family, indoor, outdoor fireplace. There's a gym there, laundry, showers, a beautiful gourmet kitchen, and all of it open to you. So that's really cool. And also just the area, 300 days of sunshine and year-round family fun. There's fishing, hunting, snow skiing, golf, river rafting, outstanding wine tasting, and more just minutes away. So they still have some lots open from phase two. They're extra large RV lots. They start at just $79,900, so $79,900. And they have a rental program where if you're not using yours, they can rent it out for you and you can make some of that money back. Yes, Nicole?
I just want to read this text that my aunt sent me yesterday.
Oh!
She's over there right now. And she said, I just want to thank you for recommending Natchez. Out of all of the resorts that we've been to, which they've been to a lot, they've been traveling in their motorhome for a few years now. This place ranks top of the list on size of the lot, the friendliest people, and the perfect location for us. I would love to support Brandy's podcast even more.
Oh my gosh, I love that. Did she mention an invite?
I think it goes. Okay. Without saying.
It'll happen. Once the pool's done.
Yeah.
Once the pool's done. Oh, that's awesome. I'm so glad. Yay. Okay. So check it out. NatchezRVResort.com. NatchezRVResort.com. All right. We got to jump into a double dose of unbelievable today. Both of them having to do with the failures of the media. Boop. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Boop. All right, 3 days ago now, on the first day that most kids were back to school, Bob Ferguson sent out a tweet on his campaign page. He said, teachers are preparing for a year of classes. They're buying supplies and spending late nights planning their curriculum. My Republican opponent, Dave Reichert, says they're overpaid. He voted to eliminate a tax break for teachers who spend their own money on school supplies. Washington families know just how important teachers are. Dave Reichert is flat wrong. Okay, so he voted to eliminate a tax break for teachers who spend their own money on school supplies. Dave Reichert, how dare you? Why would you do such a thing? Oh, that's right. You didn't do that. In fact, you were the prime sponsor on the bill in Congress to give teachers a tax break when they spend their own money on school supplies. So the exact opposite of what Bob Ferguson is saying. And Dave Reichert pointed that out on social media. Happy first day of school. More lies from my opponent. In fact, I was an original sponsor of the Teacher Tax Relief Act. Well, that's interesting. And just in case he was lying, we're like, well, let's just pull up the act. Here it is, 2014 HR 5504. Not only was Dave Reichert a prime sponsor, but he was a prime sponsor next to a Democratic congressman from Washington State at the time, McDermott. And so he supported a bipartisan bill to make sure that teachers who had to buy stuff with their own money got a tax break on those supplies. So it's just entirely factually wrong, not based in reality whatsoever. And so I've been on the last 3 days, I've been on social media. Are you going to delete this? Why isn't Bob deleting this? Like, I don't know who made the mistake, but why isn't he deleting this? I don't know how that mistake could have happened, but it's obviously entirely factually wrong. Have we seen any fact checks on it? No. Mm-mm. No. No fact checks on what is an obvious lie. Very clear. Like, it just takes 5 seconds to Google it and find out that it's wrong. You reached out to Bob Ferguson's campaign?
I did.
What did they tell us?
Crickets.
Huh? No, no, no. Read the, I'm sure they responded, right? What is, read the email response?
No, they've decided not to respond to us anymore.
Interesting. Remember, they said, I don't remember what it was. Oh, we called him out for, we asked them to provide us an example of a time where Bob Ferguson had spoken out against the police pursuit changes at any point in the last 3 years. And we asked them that and they said, we'll no longer be responding to a request for comment from Brandy Cruz because she supports Dave Reichert. But of course, we still have to do our journalistic due diligence. So Nicole, as she does, she sent them an email saying, hey, does Bob have any plans to correct the record or to take down this post? Nothing. And at last check, it's still up. Because the media lets him get away with it. If the media was instantly fact-checking things, if King, Cairo, Como, Seattle Times said, look at this lie from Bob Ferguson, he would not feel so emboldened to tell such demonstrable lies. Unbelievable. Speaking of unbelievable, let's get to another segment. Boop. All right. So on the show yesterday, which is one of my favorite stories we've done in a long time, we reported that Cairo 7 TV took an article, not an article, they took a press release that Bob Ferguson sent out. He was using his office, the Attorney General's office, to help out his political campaign by sending out a press release saying, hey, look at this case that we just came up with to try to keep a violent sex offender incarcerated. And so there were clear political motivations for him to do it. Cairo 7 took that press release and verbatim, the 100% of their story, with the exception of two words they changed, the word today to Tuesday, and they put Washington ahead of Washington Attorney General. Besides that, 100% word for word, they published the Attorney General's office politically motivated press release as a news story. So I'll say this like blew up on social media, as I knew it would, because it's plain as day. And I thought, and I had, I'm not going to say who, but I had another journalist tell me they couldn't believe how blatant this was and would be surprised if someone wasn't fired over it. And I thought, you know, I'd kind of be surprised if someone wasn't disciplined over it too. Not only, I mean, maybe somebody's been disciplined, but I find it hard to believe when the story is still up today and has not been changed. Oh, that's right. The story is still up today. I'm looking at it right now in the exact same form. Not a word changed, not an editor's note, not an update added. So we caught them red-handed. We pushed out our story. We named and shamed. People were diving in, trying to contact Cairo 7, saying, explain this. I saw the chair of the Washington State Republican Party today tagging Cairo 7, saying, can you please explain how this happened? Not a change. The story has never been updated. The last time it was touched is 4:31 p.m. yesterday. Crazy. Or 4:30 p.m. Tuesday, because we did the story on Wednesday. How do you explain that? Again, they just don't care. They just do not care. And they think it'll just go away. Not going to go away. I'm going to post about it every day. Okay? I'm going to post about it on social media every day. Okay. And I'm going to have a little clock. 6 days since Cairo put this story up and didn't change it. 7 days. And then I'm going to be like an elderly lady.
Like 9,454,006 days since Cairo put up this story.
I don't even know if humans live 9 million days. I don't think so, but maybe I will. You don't know. You don't know what cures for aging Elon Musk is going to come up with. Could be the fountain of youth.
There you go.
And I will. Mark my word. I have a countdown, count up going. Anyway, okay, we're going to get to a clip from our Sunday show, which we've been wanting to play for this week because it's just so astounding. But we've just been, man, jam-packed with stuff. And so we said, I want to give it room. So we're going to talk about it next. First, if you're in the market to sell your home, highly suggest you reach out to a few real estate agents, but do not choose one until you've picked Wes Jones. Our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. They have an innovative marketing strategy. And Wes is the son of a builder. He loves projects. I know that sounds crazy, but some people like that stuff. And they have something called the Listing Boost Concierge Service, where if you need to make some cosmetic upgrades to your home or some fixes or repairs, they can front you the money up front. Front you the money up front. A little redundant there. Front you the money. Actually come in and manage those projects, and then you just pay him on the back end after the sale. And for Sharona Rhodes and her husband, they were a little worried about that. Like, gosh, he's going to put $10,000 in. We're expected to pay him back. Are we going to get that money out of it? And she says they did.
It was a little scary, but he sent us weekly, I think, reports on how home sales were going in our area. So we knew we were on the right track. And so, you know, my husband and I are not big on debt.
Good.
But, you know, we had to be in debt to get the things done that we needed done. So it was just a lot of praying, like, Lord, just please let this happen. And then trusting that Wes knew exactly what he was talking about and that he would come through in the end, which he did.
Yeah, he was able to get their home sold for over list price in 6 days. So check out sellwithwest.com, sellwithwest.com. Start by using their free home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, I have to play a clip from our Sundays with Subscribers show this week because I just need people to hear from this woman. We're talking a lot about the sex offender issue. In fact, it was the nexus of my frustration over that Cairo 7 reporting that Bob Ferguson is trying to dig himself out of this scandal, showing that his office is under his office. Sex offenders have been released off McNeil Island at a rapid rate. And he's out there bragging about the few instances where they're able to keep someone confined. And he's not telling voters the rest of the story. And then Cairo 7, they just is able to use the media to push this like line that he's somehow protecting communities from these people when he is simply not. So one of the stories that we've told on this show is about a woman named Laura McCollum. She was the first female sex offender in Washington to be confined to McNeil Island, labeled a sexually violent predator and civilly committed after her stint in incarceration. Well, in 2020, middle of the pandemic, again, Bob would never tell you this, Laura McCollum was unconditionally released to Spokane, despite ample evidence that she still was a sexual predator, specifically a pedophile. Her crime was raping a baby. She raped a baby multiple times from 18 months old to 3 years old. She had admitted to having dozens of other victims. She was allowed for a month on sort of a trial basis to be released to Lakewood for not unconditional, but had strict conditions. 1 month later, she admitted to looking at a 6-year-old girl out the window and thinking about molesting her. So this is like as disgusting as it gets. And of course, Bob Ferguson doesn't want anyone to know about Laura McCollum. He doesn't want anyone to focus on the fact that his office and DSHS actually wrote a recommendation that Laura McCollum should be released from civil commitment on McNeil Island unconditionally. So in an effort to sort of help inform people about just how deep Bob Ferguson's lies on this issue go, we brought in the woman who literally wrote the book on Laura McCollum. Sylvia Peterson is an author, and she wrote the book Laura and Me, but she never really intended to be an author. Her story is fascinating. She herself is the victim of sexual abuse. And so she's a religious woman, she wanted for her own purposes to understand why it happened to her. Like why she was targeted and victimized. And she thought maybe having conversations with a sex offender would help her come to answers of her own. And so she got linked up with Laura McCollum on McNeil Island. And she visited her often over the course of almost a decade. And she had conversations with this horrible pedophile while she was civilly committed. And they ended up writing a book called Laura and Me, A Sex Offender and Victim Search Together to Understand, Forgive, and Heal. But Sylvia Peterson came on Sundays with Subscribers because, you know, she wanted to try to understand Laura McCollum and what made her tick. But she was never really able to. But there's one thing she absolutely believes today, and she knows Laura McCollum better than probably anyone. She absolutely believes that Laura McCollum should still be on McNeil Island and shouldn't be anywhere where she could once again victimize a child. Here's part of our conversation. I mean, you had hundreds of conversations over 9 years in where she told you things that, you know, she did going back to when she was a kid. You didn't get the sense that any of that and the release of any of that made her better?
No, I didn't. Wow.
Broken. Permanently They're broken.
Just broken.
Yeah.
Just broken. And even though she understands she's broken, she doesn't know what to do with it either. Mm-hmm. You know, and there were times she would just sit and cry. She said, I know I'm broken. Nobody knows how to fix me. Even God doesn't know how to fix me. She said, I hope I won't hurt anyone, but I could.
And that begs the question about why she is out today on unconditional release.
Do you want to know why?
Well, I do want to know why.
I'll tell you why.
So can we start first with the first attempt at release and get to that point?
Mm-hmm.
To give people context, she had a release to Lakewood on strict supervision.
Mm-hmm.
It lasted the first time about a month. Mm-hmm. As you know, and as you've written about, you know, she saw a 6-year-old out the window and thought about mm-hmm. molesting her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she went back to the mm-hmm. island. They tried again that October, a few months mm-hmm. later. She went back to the island mm-hmm. again. So just on that, if you can comment on that, the fact she's out for a month, mm-hmm. strict supervision, mm-hmm. and she still mm-hmm. it has these tendencies. Mm-hmm. What does that show you?
That she's not safe to release. Yeah. So why did they release her?
You tell me.
Because it's too expensive to keep one woman who has to have an entire wing, an entire staff, must be separate from all of the men for her own safety. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars annually to keep Laura at the SEC. And they need the space for the men.
So you believe because she's a woman and only because she's a woman, she was released unconditionally.
That's what I believe.
Wow. Because when you look at it just reasonably, mm-hmm. you know, an attempt at release, even under strict supervision, yes. is looking at a 6-year-old girl thinking about molesting her. Mm-hmm. You know, gets out again, still breaks, you know, the conditions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's less than a year later that she goes from that, failed releases, mm-hmm. to unconditional release, mm-hmm. A therapist who, you know, the court relied on in mm-hmm. making that determination said that she showed progress because she thought about having, you know, sex with a mm-hmm. 6-year-old girl, but didn't get sexually aroused. So the therapist said that was actually a sign of progress. Mm. What do you make of that assessment?
That's ludicrous.
How'd you find out she'd been unconditionally released?
One of her friends, one of the men on the island that she continued to have phone conversations with, called and told me that she had been released unconditionally, and he was sort of coaching her.
Yeah.
And I would get a call ever so often, and I finally said, you know, it's not healthy for me to know what's going on with her. It just brings it all back to me. Yeah. And it's a trigger for me. It brings me a lot of distress. I can't do anything about her.
But when you think of her being out there in the community, yeah. do you have real fears that she'll reoffend?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. She's in an apartment. The SEC allowed me to take her to Walmart shopping one time. As part of preparing her for release, we'll send a staff person with you, and you can take her to Walmart and buy her some things.
Okay.
And she was so traumatized walking up and down the aisles of Walmart because there were all these children, and she wanted them.
Wow.
And we finally had to cut that short, and I took her merchandise, and she went back to the van and I paid for her merchandise and met her in the parking lot.
Well, I think it adds credibility to your belief that the only possible reason they released her is because she was the only woman.
Yeah.
I mean, given all the other and you have the Attorney General's office who mm-hmm. petitioned, yeah, we mm-hmm. got to release her because we can't find a therapist that says she'll absolutely reoffend. And I'm thinking, well, could you ever find one that, as you say, mm-hmm. has the gift of predicting the future. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to make you get political if you don't want to. So mm-hmm. you can just say, Brandy, I'm not going there. But, you know, Bob Ferguson, mm-hmm. who this has been his office's job for the last 12 years, he has made this a key part of his campaign for governor. He said that he has been busy as the AG protecting communities from mm-hmm. these sexually violent predators, only to find out what the Seattle Times came out yeah. and reported is they've been quietly releasing them into mm-hmm. communities mm-hmm. very rapidly. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the assertion from him as he runs for governor that he's been doing his best to protect us from people like Laura?
He has created a ticking time bomb. And how many children are going to be permanently damaged before we all as citizens stand up and say, stop, stop, this is a lie. And we need to go back to the drawing board, and there's got to be something else that can be done. We must protect our children.
Yeah. That's an interview with author Sylvia Peterson. She wrote the book Laura and Me. You can listen to our full, watch our full interview at undividedpod.com by becoming a subscriber. But I just had to play a chunk of that on our public show because how powerful is that? I mean, how strong of a woman is that? You know, she went through her own abuse when she was young and, you know, spent almost a decade trying to understand it as an adult and sitting across from someone who raped a baby, had other victims. I mean, an incredibly powerful interview, but the takeaway, I think, for, you know, the conversations we're having, this is a woman who knows better than anyone what Laura McCollum is capable of. And she is astounded at the idea that the state of Washington could not or would not make a concerted effort to keep Laura McCollum on McNeil Island, away from kids, away from babies. And look, she's not a doctor. She's not a clinical psychologist. But again, do you need to be if you've had a woman who has sat and told you about her desire for children? She also told a story that, frankly, I thought might be a little too grotesque for the public show. I'll just characterize it. They were out at McNeil Island for a Christmas play, and kids came out to perform a Christmas play for these sex offenders, which is the craziest idea anyone's ever had. But Sylvia and her husband were there, you know, religious people. He's a friend of the chaplain. And Laura McCollum kept getting up and going to the bathroom, getting up, going to the bathroom, getting up, going to the bathroom. Sylvia says Laura told her that it's because she had to go pleasure herself because she was so turned on by what was happening on stage. Yet for some reason, the state of Washington's expert said, well, we can't prove that she is likely to reoffend. And again, so think of how gross all of that is, and consider all of that when Bob Ferguson says he's protecting communities from sexually violent predators. Yeah, I think not. All right, let's dip into some national news. So, of course, there's this ongoing story happening out of Colorado and now some other places. But in Colorado specifically, we showed you the video. It's been all over the place of what has been identified as gang members, Argentinian gang members. Is it Argentina? Now I forget. Anyway, Trende Aragua. Gang members. I don't know why Argentina is coming to my mind, but I don't think that's correct. What am I thinking of? Anyway, I'm sure that he will say it in this report. So there's this back and forth in Colorado, the governor being like, well, that's just made up. It's the figment of some local council member's imagination. But now they're saying, actually, yeah, this does look like this violent gang. So in the video that's been circulated on social media, you see all the gang members come up and they've got guns and stuff and they're banging on this apartment door. What'd you say? Venezuela. Venezuela. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Argentina. Sorry, Argentina. Don't cry for me, Argentina. Venezuela. Venezuelan gang members. Well, so you know who went down there and got the first ever interview with the person who lives in that apartment that the gang members were trying to get into with their guns? Our friend Jonathan Cho went down there and filed a little report.
So we're actually back at the apartment complex that's allegedly been infiltrated by Tren de Aragua, the violent Venezuelan street gang, and actually bumped into the guy who opened the door for the fellas walking around in the hallways with the guns. We spoke to him with the help of our translator.
What's that?
Does he know that his door went viral on the internet?
Sí, claro, yo guardé el video también.
So tell us what happened with those guys coming with guns.
No. Cuando nos tocaron,
he says he doesn't know them. Just when they showed up like that, he was like, okay, I'm going to come out, and whatever you're going to do, do it. They just randomly chose this door that they forced open this door too, and then they kicked down the front door on that side.
Are they Tren de Aragua?
No,
says no idea.
What did he think when they walked in with guns?
Obviously, he was scared because it was a lot of them. When in that situation, you just got to play along and let them do whatever they want.
And what did they do? They just walked in and did nothing?
I think they were just searching for something, but they didn't find it.
What's his name?
He doesn't want to give it to our recording.
Does he feel safe here?
He says he doesn't have anywhere else to go, so he's staying here.
Who gave him this apartment?
He was living downstairs and the landlord came and offered him this one.
Is he paying rent? How does he get his money?
He says he works McDonald's and other places.
Isn't that nuts? He has no idea why they were there. And they came in like looking for something, didn't find whatever they were looking for. But I gotta say, why would you open the door?
Well, because they had been smashing others down. So he was like, he wanted to play along and just say, don't hurt me. Pick oh whatever you want.
How horrifying is that? Mm-hmm. Jonathan Cho. How is Jonathan Cho the only one, the first one to get that when he's like, doesn't even live there? Don't you think anybody else in the local media, maybe they tried and couldn't get him?
Maybe.
Go Jonathan.
I know.
Love it. It's
pretty impressive.
So we'll be monitoring to see what else he
It's just finds crazy out. Down there and he hops on a plane.
Yeah.
He's I like, love
let's
it.
Go.
He's going everywhere. Chicago, Colorado. I love
it. Well, because he does stuff for Frontline's Turning Point USA, which is what that report was for, but I had to play that for you. All right.
Love it.
It's Thursday. That means we're going to check in on what's happening in the Sunshine State. Specifically, I wanted to talk with my sister in Florida about this brewing debate over abortion there. It is our segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore. People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
So you told me before we started, I've been kind of avoiding this because it's a hot topic. I'm like, do you not know the show that you're on? We love hot topics. We love it. This encompasses a few things that I'm really passionate about. You know, the democratic process and, you know, securing it, and also the abortion issue and whether it's just sort of a distraction. But so let's talk about this. So there is a effort in Florida to get rid of the six-week abortion ban. And it's being done by voters, you know, similar to how we have stuff going on here with initiatives. So they are going to put an abortion amendment on the ballot, but the DeSantis administration is looking for whether there was any fraud involved.
Yeah, correct. So petitioners across the state have collected over a million signatures in order to get Amendment 4 on the ballot in November. And now, of course, because this is something that I think DeSantis really kind of stuck pretty strong to while he's been the governor, is making sure that those signatures are actually legitimate. And I think they're calling into question at least 35 to 40,000 of those signatures to be verified to make sure that they're, you know, actually alive contributing members of Florida society.
Well, they don't even have to be contributing. They just have to be real voters.
That's true. That's true. But yeah, so I mean, I do think that all petitions and all signatures, no matter what the topic is, should be verified. I just think that that's common sense, no matter what's on the ballot. Obviously, abortion is a really, especially coming into an election such like as big as this one coming up in November, I think it's going to be a hot topic, as I said before, for a lot of voters. So as it stands right now, Florida has a 6-week abortion ban unless there's certain thing like certain criteria met in regards to like the health and safety of the mother, like if there's an issue with the fetus that maybe it's like not gonna make it, and then also if you're a victim of rape or human trafficking.
Yeah.
The amendment would make it so that it limits the government's interference with your ability to have an abortion up to fetal viability, and then also including some of those things that I just touched on that would, you know, leave it in the hands of the family to make decisions based off of the fetus's health, the mother's health, and other topics like that. So
yeah, this is okay, let's just talk about the Democratic part of it, you know, and I always attack Democrats here for attacking the initiative process. I don't believe this is that. So it sounds like in four counties, the Florida Department of State wants to review about 36,000 signatures. In our state, when initiatives go to be certified, basically what they do is a process where they kind of randomly select a bunch of signatures, do a review of those to see if the, you know, there's almost like a margin of error, like how many of them are legitimate versus not legitimate, and then they apply that to the whole. And so, you know, yeah, if the signatures are valid, great. If they're fraudulent, then yeah, we actually probably should know that. So as long as that's all they're doing is making sure that the signatures are valid or not valid, and then proceeding. So what's interesting here about the amendment, if we just talk about Amendment 4,
yeah.
So I know even Donald Trump was under fire from some pro-life advocates because he says the 6-week abortion restriction is too strict for him, that, and he's a resident of Florida, and so that's the opinion he gave. It's just there's so much daylight here. There's a huge difference between banning abortion at 6 weeks and banning it at fetal viability, which is roughly 21 to 24 weeks. So that's like that I don't even know that's much of a choice at all. In so your law, if this amendment passes in Florida, which is, you know, increasingly red state, it would be the same as Washington state's law. our law bans abortions after the point of fetal viability unless the life of the mother, et cetera, is at risk. So, I mean, I don't know if there'd be, can you gauge what the appetite is in Florida for getting rid of the 6-week abortion ban?
To be honest, I think even some of my pro-life friends find this to be a little bit of a tight ban, just based on the fact that, you know, as a woman, sometimes like our menstrual cycles aren't always on time, and 6 weeks sometimes is pushing it for one, you know, one missed menstrual cycle that could come from stress, illness, all types of other things, including pregnancy. I think it doesn't give a lot of women, especially young women who aren't completely in tune with the way their bodies feel and the way they should, you know, cycle throughout the month. I think that 6 weeks is a pretty small window for people to be able to know what's going on and make decisions in a very educated way. So it's hard to gauge anything in Florida these days, because it's such a muddy place to be politically right now. But I think that if these signatures are, you know, valid, then it should go on the ballot and let them give us a couple more months. We'll decide in November.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wish it was maybe just something to repeal the 6-week abortion ban, but not put in these other parameters, because then the state of Florida could reevaluate, because now it might end up with a very actually liberal policy on abortion as opposed to a very, very conservative policy on abortion. If that's what the people of Florida want, fine. But as these, especially after the fall of Roe, there have been multiple, you know, efforts to either codify abortion rights or expand abortion access in red and blue states. And those votes have not gone well for pro-life causes. So like even in red states. So I tend to think that even in Florida, voters would believe that 6 weeks is too extreme. So we'll see what happens. But and obviously, if for some reason there's like widespread fraud enough to derail this from going on the ballot, then that's a different conversation entirely. But we shall see. All right, Miranda, let's end it there today. That was just a great conversation about abortion. We'll leave it at that hot topic. And we will not see you again next week, but we'll see you the week after.
Oh, what are you doing next week?
It's none of your business. I'm just kidding. I'm going to Las Vegas.
Ah, fun without me.
Yes, with my loving husband. So sorry you're not invited to be a third wheel on our vacation, but love you nonetheless. Okay, see you later.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore. People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Yeah, that's gonna be quite the outcome in Florida. I really don't know what to expect there. 6 weeks is pretty, it is pretty extreme. And you know what else is extreme? Abortions up to birth. So, you know, can we just find some reasonable alternative for all of that? All right. Last week on Thursday, we do a segment with Zach Abraham of Bulwark Capital every week. It was right before Kamala Harris had done her first sit-down interview, and we kind of asked him on the show last week, like, hey, can she even do anything to convince Americans that she'd be able to handle the economy? And he said he didn't think so, but offered some pointers as to what she could say or do, or what Dana Bash with CNN should ask. And so now that interview has happened, I wanted to have Zach back on, play a portion of it for him, and have him tell us how he thinks it went. Zach Abraham, welcome back to Undivided.
Thanks for having me. Always fun to be here.
Yes, we asked you on the show last week. It was before Kamala Harris is going to sit down for her first big interview. I was going to say one-on-one. It wasn't one-on-one. It was one-on-two. And so we asked you what she needed to say to convince Americans that she could improve the economy after 3.5 years of not improving the economy. So I want you to listen to this clip.
Day one, it's going to be about, one, implementing my plan for what I call an opportunity economy. I've already laid out a number of proposals in that regard, which include what we're going to do to bring down the cost of everyday goods, what we're going to do to invest in America's small businesses, what we're going to do to invest in families, for example, extending the child tax credit to $6,000 for families for the first year of their child's life, to help them buy a car seat, to help them buy baby clothes, a crib. There's the work that we're going to do that is about investing in the American family around affordable housing, a big issue in our country right now.
What do you think, Zach? Is that convincing to you?
No, not at all. And I really don't mean this in a partisan way, right? But if you want to help American families, you extend the child tax credit for 1 year, when the child's one. How about making higher education costs tax deductible? And see, and there's so many different examples of things you could do that actually would have an impact. But and this is the problem I have. And not even just because of her political affiliation, but this is the issue that I have with a systemic liberal, right? Which is what I would call her, right? Which is they say they want to do all these things, but out of the gate, there are so many things that they cannot touch because they're politically married to them, right? So like, for instance, why isn't, you know, I mean, first of all, talk about, you know, talking and not saying anything, right? Just, you know, meme after meme after meme, no particulars, no examples, except the child tax credit. And you're sitting there going, look, families are not indebting themselves six figures because they need an extra child tax credit in the first year of somebody's life, right? Why aren't you addressing that? Because you're married ideologically to the teachers union and to the universities, right? So, and you could go on down the map, but like, you know, we got to decrease home prices, blah, blah, blah. Are you going to tell companies like BlackRock they can no longer buy up entire city blocks? Oh, no, you're not going to do that because they put how many millions of dollars into your reelection campaign? She is so, and this is the issue you've got with systemic liberals. I would almost prefer a guy like Bernie Sanders, right? At least he's not, well, he wasn't quite as pristine and clean as everybody made him out to be. But somebody that's at least ideologically pure, right? Where she's just married to so many different special interests. What she's trying to do is talk and not step on anybody's toes. I mean, that's it, right? It's all nonsense.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Bernie Sanders because it's kind of a comparison. I say in Seattle, like Shama Sawant, the former councilwoman, socialist, she was the most honest council member. Like I never had to guess, you know, where her position was, who she answered to, et cetera. I thought she was Looney Tunes, but at least she was ideologically pure. And if she took a stance, she meant it.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I also don't think that Dana Bash did a particularly good job at pushing back at like, okay, you're saying this now, but what about this? And then asking follow-up questions. So the first debate between Trump and Harris, unless one of them cancels, is coming up on Tuesday. Obviously, the economy is going to be a big issue again. So I already asked you, you know, what you thought Harris ought to do or say. What about Trump? I mean, do you have some of the same concerns with him about ideological purity or, you know, meaning what he says?
No, because I don't think that personally speaking, I don't ever get the like, I feel like Donald Trump is pretty ideologically pure in terms of I don't think there are a lot of sacred cows in this world. And I don't think there ever have been. I also don't think the idea of ticking off quote unquote supporters is particularly bothersome to him. And then the other thing that nobody wants to mention, but you're a fool to say it doesn't play a role, right? Which is nobody can promise him anything greater than what he has in terms of what, you know, nobody's going to sit there and say, hey, Donald, I'm going to give you $2 billion worth of real estate if you do what I want you to do while you're president, right? So the bar is just so much higher. I don't think he cares, right? I think he's in kind of that unique, not only is he the classic old man yelling at kids to get off his lawn, right? But it's also a palatial lawn because he's worth several billion dollars. So on the flip side of that coin, I would look at Donald and say, hey, I need you to be a little more like Kamala, right? I need you to be a little bit more tied down ideologically. And I also need you to quit with the personal attacks. Like for I'm looking at him going, my political strategy would be rope-a-dope, right? Sit back and let her punch herself out. Sit back and let her talk. When your enemy is destroying himself, don't interrupt, right? But that's what scares me about him is I'm like, you know, Donald has to bark at every passing car. So if he can be restrained and stay out of the gutter and not hurl the personal epithets and insults and all that kind of stuff, just look, her record is horrific, right? It's just like she tees it up for you. You don't need to do anything, right? Just don't talk and give her a mic.
Yeah, I agree. Bark at every passing car. That's a good analogy, although you referred to the former president as a dog, but that's fine.
Well,
that's fine. No, no, I'll send this to his campaign. No, but you make a good point. You know, it's what I think he did successfully during his Biden debate is, and for different reasons, like you had to let people see the cognitive decline. And in order to do that, you had to shut up. And so in this case, you have to let people see her lack of knowledge on policy. And you have to shut up, and hopefully he can do it again. So, Zach Abraham, we appreciate it. We will not see you next week. I will be in Vegas, and I will be enjoying it.
What a bummer. What a bummer.
Bummer for me.
Is this vacation or business?
You know, it's vacation, but I'm always on business. But it's vacation.
Where's the invite,
no,
man?
No, don't even say that, because you're on vacation literally all the time and you come back looking all bronzed and, you know, relaxed. And Nicole and I are like, what the hell, Zach? So no, I don't even do it. So I'll see you the week after next, okay?
All right, ladies. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital. We have him on the show every Thursday. I had to think if it was Thursday today to talk about what's happening with the economy, et cetera. But if you want to hear more from Zach, check out his radio show, knowyourriskradio.com. Knowyourriskradio.com. You can also find out about Bulwark Capital Management's investment strategies by getting their Common Sense Investing Guide. That's also available at knowyourriskradio.com. Okay, let's get to questions, comments. Then we've got a little bit of an emotional sanity check for you today. I mentioned earlier that for our daily subscriber show poll, I asked you guys about any concerns you might have with independent media. I want to know, you know, if there's things that concern you and where does it go from here? I want to know what those are. So on Patreon Locals and X, I asked, what is your biggest concern about the rise of independent media? The options I gave, it's too hard to know who's reliable, unclear funding sources, too many to keep track of. And I also gave you an other option so you could list what your concern might be. Bryce Philippi says, people need to do their homework before they trust a source. No traditional media can be trusted these days. Podcasters who have credibility will have to be as stand up as you. And that's a high bar. Well, I appreciate that. That's so nice. Ed OS says, we need to go back to the fairness in media law that required equal time for both sides of an issue. It was done away with in the late 80s or early 90s. I'm not familiar with that. I know there's a equal time requirement for ad buys. Maybe it used to be that way, but I'll admit that I'm not sure. Let me see. Richard says, I have no concerns. It shows the trend of people moving away from traditional media, who rightfully so are losing the trust of the people. Angela says, my only concern is that the ones that are truly independent will be canceled because of radical groupthink with all the censorship and trolling. It takes more than just independence. It takes perseverance to be heard. Yeah, I try to think of that sometimes. Like, what would it take for us to be canceled? Because we're not going to like lose all our subscribers overnight or like all of our advertisers overnight. I hope. I guess being deplatformed, if we were deplatformed, I don't even want to speak
across
it into the ether,
board,
but
yeah.
If we were deplatformed, I mean, that could temporarily shut us down, but we would persist, mm-hmm. I imagine, or we just go cry in a bowl of soup and say, I guess I'll do something else. But for you guys on the, across all the platforms, your biggest answer on Patreon and Locals is it's too hard to know who's reliable, which I can definitely understand that. I mean, we're caught in that frequently where we see something put out on social media and it's like, okay, wait, like we got to find a double source on that because I don't even know who this person is. It's some like influencer and they've got millions of viewers or millions of followers, but it's like, I don't even know who that is. So, and then on X, you guys are really evenly split between who is reliable, unclear funding sources, and too many to keep track of. Reagan on X says, I'd say all of the above, but I find people like you and Daily Wire to be credible. I also find Tim Pool to be credible. Did I miss something? I missed the first couple minutes. Yeah, you missed something. We talked about Tim Pool. But so there was a story, well, you can go back and listen to it, but there's a story about Russia backdoor funding some conservative podcasters. And it wasn't their fault. Russia used some other company as an intermediary. So it was like this weird thing. But I think it's always just a good conversation to have about like, what are your concerns as we continue doing this, right? Other questions and comments on Chris Rakedahl saying, oh, well, this explains why people don't want to go to public schools is because Russia's funding the right wing to say that school choice is a bad idea. Jim says, we were for school choice long before Trump and their Trump derangement syndrome. Jason explains things. Is that the, I like that as a screen name. Jason explains things. I love how he's limited who he can respond to his post. Yeah, on that Chris Rakedahl post, I don't know if you noticed that. Mm-hmm. He he could only, I was able to respond because he follows me, but only people he mentioned or followed could respond.
Right.
And I was like, that's
not shocking. I think that, I mean, it's pretty funny in his description of his ex account. I mean, he's very clear that that's not him speaking as OSPI.
Yeah.
That's him speaking as Chris.
Yeah, you can say that, but you're still the OSPI
director.
But you're
still, that gives us an idea of who Chris, mm-hmm. the OSPI, is.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Ben Garrett. The only reason Democrat politicians oppose school choice is because they're funded by the teachers' unions. Exactly. That's mm-hmm. it. They don't care about kids or their parents' choices. Marksman Hitman says there should be help for homeschoolers and funding for books and online lessons. There's none of that other than that I know of, and I pay for all three kids. Talk about no funds for gas and groceries. Yeah, if you're paying for all that stuff. And then you still, it's not like you get an exemption from property taxes or from paying into mm-hmm. the school system. So that's kind of the issue here. And I did get that thing done. Okay, just letting you know. A little behind the scenes chatter here. Baron of Gray Matter with a $5 super chat. We're at $18,750 per student. What would benefit students is choice. My student, my choice voucher program. Parents can choose where to send their kids. And that's the issue. Okay, if you're going to let families opt out of public school, right? Well, you have to. If a family wants to send their kid to private school or homeschool, then, and they can opt out of paying taxes in the school system, then that's fine.
Right.
Then we don't have to talk. We don't even have to have this conversation, because then the money you'd be putting into the public school system is your own money to do with what you see fit. But that's not what's going on.
It's a, I mean, that's a lot of money. $18,000. I mean, I know people who put their kids in private school, and I mean, it's that expensive, and yeah, give them the money and let them go. I have some friends in Indiana, and their kids do go to private school through a voucher system, and they love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They love it.
And it's like it was said earlier, if student outcome is the goal, which isn't it? Shouldn't it be?
Shouldn't it be?
Then mm-hmm. choice wouldn't be a concern. If public schools were doing great, then you wouldn't be worried about them having a choice to do something else. It's just insane. Let me see here. On the media. Oh, Baron of Gray Matter. No, I just read that. On the media. Having a moment. I need food right now. I am hangry. Greg Anderson says, Brandy Cruz, yes. How do we contact any of the news outlets to register our disdain for the way they cover or not cover Dems and the initiatives? How and whom do we contact at the news channels? Every news website will have like contact us and like a generic email or a phone. They hate it when you call them on the phone.
You're looking for a news director or a program director, that type of thing.
News director, editor, program director. Yeah. You can usually, the tricky thing with that Cairo 7 story is it's written by Cairo 7 staff.
Right.
And that's like the way to, if you don't want to take ownership of something, like, oh, a staff member wrote it. Whereas if it was a reporter who wrote it and put their name on it, you could click and email them.
That would be plagiarism.
Anybody who I used to work with, whether it was at Cairo Radio back then or Fox 13, knows my rule. My name would not go on a story I didn't write, and I would never write a story I didn't put my name on. Mm-hmm. So that was my rule, is I was going to take ownership of it, and you were never allowed to change the headline on my story unless I approved it, because that was something that would frequently be done, and I'd be like, absolutely not, because I'd 90% of the time be mad with the headline.
Right.
So you got to take ownership of what you do. So not a surprise that this is Cairo. How many days? What's the over-under? You guys tell me. How many days until they take the story down or edit it in some way?
You know, the fact that they haven't done it already, to me, that is the signal that they don't want to admit it. They don't want to acknowledge it, and because they should have already.
So you think the limit does not exist?
I'm not sure it does. I think they're just going to let it ride. But
what do you guys think?
I mean, it depends on how much pressure. If we amp up the pressure through our audience and other media people that have let us know that they were just as shocked by it.
Yeah.
If something like that happens, but just us calling them out and identifying it has not worked.
And you might say, well, shaming them is enough. No, it's not, because that story still exists out there. And it's in the middle of an election year where he's doing that. He wanted that story pushed because he's running for governor. So we can't take back. I don't know if they aired this in their newscast. I'm assuming they did some version of it. So if they aired it, this was our rule at Fox as well. We had not when I left, but for a long time at Fox 13, we had a news director who was just awesome. And she was very serious about, you know, accuracy, all this stuff. So you had to correct if you got something wrong, you had to correct it on the platform you got it wrong on. Mm-hmm. So if I tweeted out something that was wrong, I had to correct it on Twitter. If I said something on the other was wrong, I had to correct it on air. If it was just web, I had to correct it on web. So it forces you to be accountable, right? And so, yeah, if it was on TV, they need to correct it on TV in the time slot where they said it. Mm-hmm. So people are more likely to see because it needs to be corrected. So, yeah, we'll amp up the pressure.
Man.
All right.
Remember when managers did that?
Feel bad for that.
Good, yeah. Managers, good.
Like, hey, we're accountable to people.
Yeah.
You know, that boss I talked to who is great, Erica Hill, you know, she would never, if it was a mistake made in good faith, she had your back, but that didn't mean that you didn't have to do something to fix it. You know what I mean? She wasn't going to give you cover, I guess. Yeah. She wanted you to learn from the mistake, but you had to take accountability for it.
Do you know what the problem is, I think, right now?
What is it?
It is that managers even, I mean, and it stems from this HR, this DI, all of these things, but it's all people worried about feelings. And so instead of the business coming first, it doesn't anymore. Business and the product and the quality and really pride and ownership of that product is not what comes first anymore. Yeah. It is the feelings and what everything is suffering because of it. So you think you're protecting somebody's feelings. No, you're making them a better or a worse worker, right? Yeah. You're making the product worse. And that is that's their livelihood. You're making everything worse by protecting feelings when it shouldn't be about that.
And then it won't
should
get
be about
better.
It's not going to improve. Yeah. They're not going to improve as people if you support their future, you know, aspirations, growth. Then you would tell them how to get better. And yeah. I worked with people that, I mean, every job I had, I feel like I grew with. And I mean, people were constantly giving me lessons, and that's fine. And I want to be told when I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I tell you that a lot. Tell me when I'm wrong. I don't always take it well. I'm not saying that. But I do want to be told.
But yeah, I think part of it's that, but the media doesn't want criticism either. The mm-hmm. media spends all its days criticizing other mm-hmm. people, right? And then the second you criticize the media, it's like, how dare you?
Oh.
Are you that? You lack that much self-awareness that you don't realize that's your whole job, but you won't take an ounce of criticism?
Right.
It's insane. But yeah, I mean, I guess maybe they fired somebody and we just don't know it. But you'd think if they fired someone over this article, the article would be taken down, right?
Right.
Right.
Or they would say the matter has been resolved.
Right. Or a little editor's note.
Whoops.
Like, we're aware that this is horrible.
Right.
Journalistic malpractice.
But also, if things are getting posted like that and the managers or what, it hasn't gone through the ranks, that's a problem. Like,
huge
there
problem.
Needs to be a rank system. And that's the thing that we complain about all the time is that there is just there's no management of media anymore. That.
Well, I'll just give one example. Sorry, we're belaboring this and I'll close the show here in a second.
It's so frustrating.
It is. We'll give one example. So you guys will remember this story. And I was like, we were forbade from talking about it. But now I'm not there. And I don't think I signed an NDA. So you guys do remember when on Fox 13, somebody manipulated Donald Trump's face.
Yep.
So they had this video of him and they artificially made his mouth bigger and then slowed it down. So his tongue was like.
Wasn't he orange?
Yeah, it made him oranger. Mm-hmm. And he was like. Mm-hmm. You know, it was crazy. The reason that got on the air isn't some grand conspiracy. It was one editor who didn't like Donald Trump, mm-hmm. who had no oversight. So you could literally have an editor, and we changed things after that. You could have an angry editor who decided, I'm going to put this video on the air, and it's just going to play because no one would check things. And it was just this total breakdown in editorial, like, mm-hmm. oversight. So people thought, oh, Fox 13. Like, in this case, I bet this is just like it's probably an inexperienced digital person who doesn't know that you can't take a government press release and just treat it like a news story. Now, the fact that it's stayed up when management clearly knows about it means it's a bigger issue, right? But so, anyway.
Plagiarism.
No,
it is clear.
Well, you can't really plagiarize the government, but it's.
But you put your name on it.
You put your name on it,
even your staff.
And it's just acting as a propaganda wing for the government, right. Which is my big concern. Mm-hmm. Let's just do two more. On Fergie, Lynn Julin says, on the Bob Ferguson issue, did he do this on X? We could start a community notes. There is a community notes under his lie about Dave Reichert. It just needs enough rankings to be, because it links to the bill that Dave Reichert mm-hmm. introduced and prime sponsored. So it just needs enough rankings.
So go do that so we can.
If you are a community mm-hmm. notes person, not everyone is on X, go mm-hmm. go give it a ranking. And then on Florida, Liz says birth control is cheap for free. No excuses for abortions after or for 21 abortions. Yeah.
They were talking. There was some comments talking about all these people bragging about how many abortions they've had.
When you brag about your abortion, you completely lose me. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not something to brag about. Okay, so last night we went to the memorial walk for Ruth Dalton, who, of course, is the 80-year-old dog walker who was murdered by an 8-time felon in broad daylight in Seattle. Let's talk about it in our closing, a little more emotional than usual, sanity check. So, you know, I'm not going to get into too much of the politics about it. You know, we went, we did the about a mile long walk. And I think it was, it's frustrating for me, I guess, for people to show up who are contributing to the issue and to act like they're not. So I'll leave that there. But I will say there was we walked up to Madison Park from the scene of the crime to Madison Park. And then there was a pastor who knew Ruth, has known Ruth for years, who offered a really moving prayer, and I thought we'd end today by playing that prayer for you.
Let us pray. Holy God, holy and mighty, holy immortal one, you gather us around the life of Ruth, a person of faith, a person who revealed your love in everything that she did, the way she cared for her animals, the way in which she cared for her family, the way in which she cared for her neighbors. For that, we give you thanks, for the privilege of being a part of her life, for the privilege of knowing her. It's hard to lose her. It is a surprise, and it breaks our hearts and causes us to be confounded by such a lovely person being taken so quickly. And yet we give you thanks for knowing her, and we give you thanks for engaging her with us and for the love that she's left behind, that she may be a model of grace and joy in each of our lives. Amen.
I had to let that play because after the prayer got done, all of a sudden, all the dogs, because dogs were welcome. You know, Ruth loved dogs. And so there were so many people, including Mike and I. We brought our dog Lucky, who brought their dogs. And for some reason, it had been pretty quiet, like a couple dogs here and there. And then after the prayer was over and he said, amen. That was just the big, it was like this chorus of dog barks. And I had stopped the video and I wish I hadn't stopped it so soon because all the dogs were just going nuts. And it was like just a really powerful moment. So justice for Ruth, justice for her little dog Prince, and hopefully a recognition that we can't continue to do the same things we've done, and hope that this crime crisis, this public safety crisis we're in that's taking innocent lives, will fix itself. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Coming up on Sundays with Subscribers, we're going to be joined by a journalist with the National Review who has been doing extensive reporting on what's happening in Washington State's prison for women, specifically around the issue of transgender inmates. She is very well sourced. She's been speaking to some of these female inmates on the condition of anonymity. Sometimes they speak to her on the record, and she's just, I mean, absolutely dead set on trying to change something for these women behind bars. So if you have not signed up to become a subscriber already, please do so. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. And a reminder, actually, you know, Nicole, we should probably put it up. Am I allowed to just abruptly?
Do I have a graphic for it? I don't think I do.
Maybe not. Be an Eden Claw tomorrow. I posted it across all my platforms. We're having a meet and greet with Dave Reichert, 5 to 6 p.m. outside Casting Iron in the beer garden in Enumclaw for Cruising Coal. So please join us and we'll do another round of reminders across social media. But until then, I will see subscribers on Sunday. I'll see the rest of you Monday at noon.